And he has two that I want to read today. The first one is called, "And Now We Bring You the Final Fire." We graduated from grade school with a group major in air raid. The 50s were all baseball and bomb shelters, wailing sirens, go to the cloakroom, short blasts away from the windows, bright flash and silence, take cover. Do you remember those hours under your low desk, wondering if the nation under God with liberty had been done in? I don't know about you, but I knew I'd never make it to the eighth grade. The final fire was coming, with 3 minutes warning at most. Once a month there was a movie with houses exploding in slow motion, dummies in the cellar, winds tossing them beneath the mushroom shadow, and civil defense ladies explaining how the glass would get you if you didn't behave. If you are like me, you forgot those drills, those practices for death, except at noontime now and then when some worker's lunch whistle screeches terror through your bones and you are frightened for an instant, ready to dive beneath your dignity. At such moments I am taken in again as to the old Arlington Theater, and I am the last surviving Humphrey Bogart, desperately looking for my Katharine Hepburn. But the final fire would be more than burning the African Queen, and we knew it. Ground Zero was just across the Potomac River. Assaulting sunlight greets me as after midday movies, when I return to what we think of as the real world. When the ball of fire flashes in your eyes, take cover, they said. You are about to be made into coal, and then, with luck, into diamonds. When I feel the terror coming on, tossing his rage-made fire on our flimsy houses, on poor frenzied dummies, on ourselves. But neither myths nor movies make sense of it. We were right to forget, perhaps. We did, after all, make it to the eighth grade. But like all surviving species of the world's long ache, we left something of ourselves at that moment of mutation, as horses left their toes at the forest's edge. Crouched under small desks, we may have learned to pray, but we forgot how to trust. Trust fire, noonday sirens, sudden blasts of sunshine, and the future. The massive cost of our new fire is the careless spirit of childhood. We must do all now or burn. We will laugh again, but though we try to forget, we will never quite relax again. Old ovens, new napalm, dark journeys update. Struck down by fire disease, Abel lets his fever speak. I burn in new ways, brother. You are ingenious with your flames. Terror made flesh in Cain and his children, tortures with slavery, caste, class injustice, conflict of colors, innumerable slanders, but none of it compares to the burning cowardice that opened ovens 6 million times while Abel and his line prepared to wash themselves. And later the headlines read, "Catholics absolve Jews of crucifixion." Drops of pity began to fall on the fallen, but before they soothed him, it was fire falling in new ways still. You are ingenious with your flames. When Cain married the machine at Tokyo and Hiroshima and Nagasaki, he traded faces for fire, and Abel's eyes squinted, and the headlines read, "Victory and peace at last." Cain drags still to his altar brothers he does not know, jellies them with fire that clings like hatred, unmerciful, indiscriminate, inescapable. You are ingenious with your flames, and the headlines read, "Free fire zones cleared." God, speaking through fevers of Abel and his children, says, "Cain, what have you done to my gift of fire? It was the sign of your brotherhood." But he does not hear. Cain thinks by now his name is Abel. He believes his theft of innocence, though perverted fire and terror-made flesh warns him, murderer, victim, both. Cain still dances at his altar, relishing the acid smell of sacrifice. And still the smoke, ingenious as its flame, refuses to rise. Well, prophets do not have good words. That's what makes them prophets. And today, as we look at Habakkuk, we are moving more than a century away from the great 8th century prophets that we have been reading, and turning instead now to a prophet at the time of the exile. The other prophets that we were reading, Amos and Hosea in the northern kingdom, and Micah and Isaiah in the southern kingdom, all of these prophets looked at a dominant Assyria that was able to sweep everything in its path, conquer everything, and they were the prophets looking at the doom of the northern kingdom. Samaria destroyed, the 10 tribes carried off into captivity, every last vestige of the kingdom obliterated. That happened in 721 B.C., and we're now moving more than a century later, with the southern kingdom still operating. No major upheavals, the Davidic line intact, an unbroken line of kings in Judah from David on now down to Josiah. Josiah was, in fact, one of the great reformers among the kings of Israel, and most scholars today date the book of Deuteronomy from the time of Josiah and refer to his reform as the Deuteronomic Reform. That is, an attempt once again to establish the religion or the faith of Yahweh in the land. We have to remember continually that the whole of the Old Testament, at least up to the exile, is the history of the attempt to, is the history of the conflict between the faith of Yahweh and the culture religions of Canaan. That's going on continually. Josiah makes one more attempt to reform Israel or reform Judah. But other things are happening on the world stage. Assyria, which had been dominant for so long and which was nearly synonymous with terrible cruelty, the Assyrians were not benign conquerors at all. I think if we want to, one of the interesting things to read these days are some of the retrospective histories now of World War II. And the many ways in which the Nazis defeated themselves, many of the places into which the German armies went in the 1940s were places that welcomed them as liberators. And if they could have capitalized on that kind of welcome, particularly in places like the Ukraine, who knows what the history of the 20th century might have been. But Nazi ideology was that the Slavs were literally made to be a slave people, and so they awakened partisan groups and hastened their own defeat. The Assyrians were like that. They were implacable, terrible, savage, cruel conquerors. And they were defeated with the fall of Nineveh in 612 B.C., so about 110 years or so after the destruction of Samaria and the northern kingdom. And the book of the prophet Nahum celebrates that defeat. I just want to read the final verses. Your shepherds are asleep, O king of Assyria. Your nobles slumber. Your people are scattered on the mountains with none to gather them. There is no assuaging your hurt. Your wound is grievous. All who hear the news of you clap their hands over you, for upon whom has not come your unceasing evil? So when Assyria went, and Nahum's final oracle, the book just before Habakkuk, Nahum's final oracle is the celebration of this defeat of Assyria. When that happened, there were now once again two powers looking for dominance in the area. Egypt was one, and Babylon is arising now, the Chaldean Empire, arising in the neighborhood of Assyria. And Egypt suddenly changed its policies. Instead of being in conflict with Assyria, Egypt now decides to help Syria because it says Babylon is worse. Again, we have to think of the kinds of policy shifts. We were militantly against communism in the 30s, but when communism and Nazism began to fight in 1941, we said Nazism is worse. Russia suddenly became an ally. Stalin was a nice guy. We did all kinds of foreign policy shifts. When we decided after the war that communism was bad, we began to look for allies among fascists whom we had just defeated. So Franco was now suddenly a friend. Okay, Egypt is going through those kinds of policy gyrations. And Pharaoh Necho, who died in 594 BC, decides suddenly, after centuries of fighting Assyria, to come to Assyria's aid. And in 609, he marches north to help Josiah take on the... he marches north to help Assyria. He meets Josiah's army at the Battle of Megiddo. And there Josiah is killed in a battle with the Egyptians. Judah was defeated. It may be that Josiah was captured and executed. We do not know. But he had wanted to reunite the northern and the southern kingdoms. Egypt and its foreign policy was interfering with that. And Josiah's reform and his far-sighted policies were nipped in the bud.
Well, I just want to note, our word Armageddon comes from Megiddo.
Yes, okay, that was...
So important
in Hebrew imagination. Right. That was, in a sense, their last sort of great hope to reestablish some unity of in their own territory, and it was went down to defeat at that battle. Pharaoh Necho went on to challenge Babylon then, having defeated Judah and picking up his Assyrian allies who really weren't all that much help to him. Necho went on to a war with Babylon and was decisively defeated at Carchemish in 605 BC by Nebuchadrezzar II. And that established then Babylonian or Chaldean supremacy in that area, and it was time to make peace with the new power. The problem was that Israel was not given any kind of enlightened leadership at the time. Jehoahaz, who was Josiah's successor in 609, ruled for just 3 months and was followed by Jehoiakim, who was a cruel, selfish, indulgent despot. Exactly the last sort of thing that Judah needed in a king. He put a prophet to death. We are told the story in the book of Jeremiah. The prophet Uriah was killed. It doesn't take very long to read this. I'll read it. Can read it, I think, relatively quickly. There was another man who prophesied in the name of the Lord, Uriah the son of Shemaiah from Kiriath Jearim. He prophesied against this city and against this land in words like those of Jeremiah. And when King Jehoiakim with all his warriors and all the princes heard his words, the king sought to put him to death. But when Uriah heard of it, he was afraid and fled and escaped to Egypt. Then King Jehoiakim sent to Egypt certain men, Elnathan, the son of Achbor, and others with him. And they fetched Uriah from Egypt and brought him to the king, to King Jehoiakim, who slew him with the sword and cast his dead body into the burial place of the common people. So prophets weren't all that safe. Jeremiah certainly had his continual fear for his life. Jehoiakim finally let his pride and his overweening sense of self-importance and power lead him into a revolt, and the Chaldeans, the Babylonians, came, captured Jehoiakim, led him off into exile in 598. They put Zedekiah on the throne. Zedekiah was a was a vassal of the Babylonians, and but Zedekiah was surrounded by people who again urged on them what, from Jeremiah's point of view, was a mistaken foreign policy. The burden of Jeremiah's prophecy was, accept our fate, in a sense, accept the doom that is coming upon us. We will be a vassal state, we will have people in exile, we need to go along with that. But Zedekiah was surrounded by people who again urged revolt from Babylon. And in 586, then the Chaldeans came, the Babylonians came, and put an end to the kingdom of Judah, even as the northern kingdom had been destroyed in 621. Zedekiah was made to watch the execution of his sons as the last thing he saw before his eyes were put out, and then he was led away into captivity. The temple was destroyed. There are pictures of carvings in stone of the conquerors carrying off the sacred vessels from the temple, the candlesticks, everything. The city was laid waste. Most of the population carried off into Babylonian captivity. Now, it's in this period of time, perhaps surely after Josiah's death in 609, but probably before the final exile in 586, that the prophet Habakkuk writes. And Habakkuk is a contemporary of Jeremiah's. I chose Habakkuk because we haven't got time to, you can't look at all of Jeremiah in one session, but you can look at all of Habakkuk in a session. And Habakkuk is wrestling with the problem of the suffering of the righteous. Josiah was the last best king of Judah. Not the last king, but certainly one of the kings with great good vision. And Josiah was the one who was either executed, possibly executed, but certainly defeated when he was doing a good thing, when he was trying to restore the religion of Yahweh, when he was engaged in uprightness and justice and purity of religion. Remember that the other prophets, the great 8th century prophets, went after two primary things. One, the injustice, the economic injustice that was going on in prosperous Israel and Judah, where the poor were exploited, sold for a pair of shoes, Amos says. And the other thing that they went after, particularly characteristic of Micah and Hosea, was the idolatry and the Baalism, the religion of the way things are, trying to find out how the world works and just going along with that. And the two belong together. If you find out how the world works, then your motto is do others before they do you. So economic injustice and the religion of Baalism, of the way things are, will go hand in hand. Josiah was against all of this. Josiah was a reformer in the best sense of the word. And when it happens to him, then we get a lament like Habakkuk's. Habakkuk is divided into three sections, clearly three sections. The first one is a lament over the suffering of the righteous. The second is a series of five prophetic woes. And the third is a liturgical song, a prayer that is cast in the form of a psalm. In fact, you can even see that form in terms of some of the technical terms. There are three technical terms used. Shigionoth, you see that at the top of Psalm 7, for example, where we are told that Psalm 7 is a what? A Shigion of David. Here we are told this is a Shigionoth. And then you see the technical term Selah. I don't know what that means. Maybe somebody does. And then finally at the end to the choir master with stringed instruments, this is to be sung. So we've got chapter 3 is a psalm. chapter 2, most of it are five woes. We'll take a look at them. And then the section, the lament for the righteous. Let's start with the woes first. Five oracles, beginning with chapter 2, verse 6. We don't know anything about Habakkuk. You know, nothing about where he comes from. We know where Micah comes from Marosheth. We know where Amos comes from, Tekoa. We know something about his occupation. We know that Micah was a small village thinker, a small Iowa newspaper editor, I said yesterday, who writes his editorials on national affairs. And we know that we know a lot about Hosea's biography because his biography, especially his marriage, is the content of his prophetic vision. We don't know anything about Habakkuk, nothing. The name, that's it. But you can tell when Habakkuk comes because of the historical references, because of the kind of thing that's happening. Habakkuk is the prophet who looks at exile and tries to figure out what's going on. But let's look at his five woes first. These are oracles. You can think of them as poems of judgment or sermons of judgment oracles. Beginning with 2 verse 6. Shall not all these take up their taunt against him in scoffing derision of him and say, woe to him who heaps up what is not his own, for how long, and loads himself with pledges. Will not your debtors suddenly arise, and those awake who will make you tremble? Then you will be booty for them. It's a way of saying, you know, if you plunder others, you're going to get yours. You see, someday they will arise, and then woe to you. I read this and I think of OPEC, you know. Because you have plundered many nations, all the remnant of the people shall plunder you. For the blood of men and violence to the earth, to the cities, and all who dwell therein. That's the first woe. Woe to him who gets evil gain for his house, to set his nest on high, to be safe from the reach of harm. You have devised shame to your house by cutting off many peoples. You have forfeited your life, for the stone will cry out from the wall and the beam from the woodwork respond. There ain't no security in security, I guess, would be the summary of that oracle. Woe to him who builds a town with blood and founds a city on iniquity. Behold, it is not from the Lord of hosts that peoples labor only for fire and nations weary themselves for naught. For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Woe to him who makes his neighbors drink of the cup of his wrath and makes them drunk to gaze on their shame. Maybe that's what we do to the Mexicans. Huh? You will be sated with contempt instead of glory. Drink yourself and stagger. The cup of the Lord's right hand will come round to you. Shame will come upon your glory. The violence done to Lebanon will overwhelm you. The destruction of the beasts will terrify you. For the blood of men and violence to the earth, to cities, and to all who dwell therein. And the final. Woe. What profit is an idol when its maker has shaped it, a metal image, a teacher of lies? For the workman trusts in his own creation when he makes dumb idols. Woe to him who says to a wooden thing, awake, to a dumb stone, arise. Can this give revelation? Behold, it is overlaid with gold and silver, and there is no breath at all in it. And the final word on these five woes, but the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before him. Well, we use that frequently as a way to begin our worship. I'm not quite sure that that's what Habakkuk means when he puts it at the end of these woes. He is saying God's running the show, and you people, you know, you're finally going to be reduced to silence before him. That's what it is. It doesn't mean shut up so you can hear Paul Monson's prelude. It means God is going to do something to you. You know, it's interesting to see how we take verses out of context in the Bible and put them into totally different contexts where they do not mean anything at all that they mean. If you listen to these woes, you know, then you see that what the prophet is really saying here is our babbling will be put to silence because we have created for ourselves religions in our own image. I think Charlie is going to talk about some of that in the next hour after coffee break today, so I'm not going to say anything about that. But we have created religions in our own image, and then we expect these religions to do the job for us. Amos was the one who said that God hates the noise of our solemn assemblies and is appalled by the babbling of our worship. So when the prophet here says the Lord is in his holy temple, let all the earth keep silence before him, he's really saying an end to our homemade religions, to our idolatries, to our injustices, to the ways we have exploited our neighbors and our world. We're going to get ours, and that's the way this word ends. Well, that's the prophet part in Habakkuk. We've come to expect this kind of a word from all of the prophets that we have read. Amos especially is a word, a prophetic word in which there is almost unrelieved judgment. But now in Habakkuk, there are two parts to the prophet, the beginning and the end, that surround these woes, which are really very, very instructive as the prophet looks at the doom that is gathering, at the darkness that is coming around. The first is a lament, and it's an interesting oracle in which the prophet and God engage in a conversation. The first four verses of Habakkuk are the prophet raising an age-old question. The oracle of God which Habakkuk the prophet saw, O Lord, how long shall I cry for help, and thou wilt not hear, or cry to thee violence, and thou wilt not save? Why dost thou make me see wrongs and look upon trouble? Destruction and violence are before me. Strife and contention arise. So the law is slacked, and justice never goes forth. For the wicked surround the righteous, so justice goes forth perverted. I couldn't think of a more poignant modern statement of that, and there are a lot of them, you know, of people who just want to be blinded from the vision of injustice. The best one I know, at least, is Elie Wiesel's description of Rosh Hashanah in a concentration camp from his little autobiographical book, Night. I just want to say something, I guess, about this. If you have not read Night, it's the memoir of a teenage boy who had to grow up in a hurry when his family, the Jewish community in, I think it was Hungary, first was put under restrictive laws, then walled up into a ghetto, then all hauled off to Buchenwald, where his mother and his young sister were immediately sent to the gas chambers, and he and his father were put to work in work battalions. He survived, but brutally scarred, and this just takes us to the end of the
his
concentration
died
camp.
From exhaustion.
Yeah, his father dies before the thing is over, and that is sort of the last thing that happens in the book. But you just must read this. Anyway, this is the description of Rosh Hashanah. The summer was coming to an end, the Jewish year nearly over. On the eve of Rosh Hashanah, the last day of the accursed year, the whole camp was electric with the tension which was in all our hearts. In spite of everything, this day was different from any other. The last day of the year. The word last rang very strangely. What if it were indeed the last day? They gave us our evening meal, a very thick soup, but no one touched it. A very thick soup. Curious, you know, how the tormentors can twist the knife. Think of that for a moment. What is the eve of Rosh Hashanah? It is fast day. When do you give them thin soup, the missing of which wouldn't be all that much? Not on a fast day. Then you give them the best soup you can make, you see, so that the fasting is all the more cruel. Can we think of what this means? A very thick soup, but no one touched it. We wanted to wait until after prayers. At the place of assembly, surrounded by the electrified barbed wire, thousands of silent Jews gathered, their faces stricken. Night was falling. Other prisoners continued to crowd in from every block, able suddenly to conquer time and space and submit both to their will. What are you, my God, I thought angrily, compared to this afflicted crowd proclaiming to you their faith, their anger? What does your greatness mean, Lord of the universe, in the face of this weakness, this decomposition, and this decay? Why do you still trouble their sick minds and their crippled bodies? 10,000 men had come to solemn attention. Heads of the blocks, capos, functionaries of death. Blessed be the Eternal! The voice of the officiant had just made itself heard. I thought at first it was the wind. Blessed be the name of the Eternal! Thousands of voices repeated the benediction. Thousands of men prostrated themselves like trees before a tempest. Blessed be the name of the Eternal! Why? But why should I bless him? In every fiber I rebelled. Because he had had thousands of children burned in his pits, because he kept six crematories working night and day on Sundays and feast days, because in his great might he had created Auschwitz, Birkenau, Buna, and so many factories of death, how could I say to him, Blessed art thou, eternal maker of the universe, who chose us from among the races to be tortured day and night, to see our fathers and mothers and brothers end in the crematory. Praised be thy holy name, thou who hast chosen us to be butchered on thine altar. I heard the voice of the officiant rising up, powerful, yet at the same time broken, amid the tears, the sobs, the sighs of that whole congregation. All the earth and the universe are God's. He kept stopping every moment as though he did not have the strength to find the meaning beneath the words. The melody choked in his throat. And I, mystic that I had been, I thought, yes, man is very strong, greater than God. When you were deceived by Adam and Eve, you drove them out of paradise. When Noah's generation displeased you, you brought down the flood. When Sodom no longer found favor in your eyes, you made the sky rain fire and sulfur. But these men here, whom you have betrayed, whom you have allowed to be tortured, butchered, gassed, burned, what did they do? They pray before you. They praise your name. All creation, said the officiant, bears witness to the greatness of God. Once New Year's Day had dominated my life. I knew that my sins grieved the Eternal. I implored his forgiveness. Once I had believed profoundly that upon one solitary deed of mine, one solitary prayer, depended the salvation of the world. But on this day I ceased to plead. I was no longer capable of lamentation. On the contrary, I felt very strong. I was the accuser and God the accused. My eyes were open and I was alone, terribly alone, in a world without God and without man, without love, without mercy. I had ceased to be anything but ashes, yet I felt myself to be stronger than the Almighty, to whom my life had been tied for so long. And I stood amid that praying congregation, observing it like a stranger. That's what Habakkuk is feeling as he raises this lament to God about the suffering of the righteous. So the law is slacked, and justice never goes forth,
For the wicked surround the righteous, so justice goes forth perverted. See, we have to understand what it is like to be victims, because we do not really know that. None of us knows that. And above all, we do not know what it is to be the unjust sufferers, that is, the sufferers who really, in some sense, have done nothing to deserve this. That's why it's very difficult for us, I think, to put ourselves in the position of the Native Americans that Paul Bowe is talking about, or the Black Americans that have been mentioned often this summer, although we haven't had any Black people on the faculty or even many in the village. You know, we don't know what that is like. We don't know why the hatred of many nations is now arising against us, you see, for things that we have done. Why the Iranians want so desperately to get rid of Americans. Why they hate it even that they have to sell oil to us in order to survive. See, we don't understand much of that. The prayer of the suffering of the unjust is usually prayed against us. God answers the prophet here. Look among the nations and see, wonder and be astonished. For I am doing a work in your days that you would not believe if I told. Look what God is doing now. Below, I am rousing the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation, who march through the breadth of the earth to seize habitations not their own. Dread and terrible are they. Their justice and dignity proceed from themselves. Their horses are swifter than leopards, more fierce than the evening wolves. Their horsemen press proudly on. Yea, their horsemen come from afar. They fly like an eagle, swift to devour. They all come for violence. Terror of them goes before them. They gather captives like sand. At kings they scoff, and of rulers they make sport. They laugh at every fortress, for they heap up earth and take it. Then they sweep by like the wind and go on, guilty men whose own might is their God. Some reply from God, isn't it, to the prophet's lament? Huh? I mean, you look for an answer. I don't know how many of you have seen the movie Oh God, but I keep thinking, you know, the kinds of questions that we address to God, we get crazy answers for. And this one, as the prophet is in dialogue with God, gets the craziest answer of all. The prophet says, Lord, what in the world is going on? Where is justice? And God says, look what I'm doing. You won't believe it, but I'm raising up the Chaldeans and they're going to be worse than the Assyrians. That's what he says. You know? So now the prophet speaks again. Art thou not from everlasting, O Lord, my God, my Holy One? We shall not die. O Lord, thou hast ordained them as a judgment. See, he's answering what God is saying here. He is entering into the judgment that God is visiting. That's why this is one of the most astonishing books in the whole of the Old Testament. It is a prophet saying, I know what you are doing, God, and I'm going to go along with it. O Lord, thou hast ordained them as a judgment, and thou, O rock, hast established them for chastisement. Thou who art of purer eyes than to behold evil and canst not look on wrong, why dost thou look on faithless men and art silent when the wicked swallows up the man more righteous than he? For thou makest men like the fish of the sea, like crawling things that have no ruler. He brings all of them up with a hook. He drags them out with his net. He gathers them in his seine. So he rejoices and exults. Now the he changes again. Here he'd been talking about God. Now he talks about the response. Therefore he, that is the worshiper, sacrifices to his net and burns incense to his seine. For by them he lives in luxury and his food is rich. Is he then to keep on emptying his net and mercilessly slaying nations forever? Now come these great words. The prophet says, I will take my stand to watch and station myself on the tower and look forth to see what he, God, will say to me and what I will answer, what I will answer concerning my complaint. Wow. It's almost like Wiesel, but notice the difference here. You know, Wiesel is saying, now at last I saw that we are stronger than this God who does this to us. And my eyes were open, he says, and I saw myself in a world without God and without men. I remember a sermon that I read once by John Arthur Gossip. And it was preached after some terrible tragedies in his own family. And he talks about, I think he took his text again from the Old Testament, about how if we cannot walk with the footmen, how shall we run with the chariots? And if we cannot ford the brook, how are we going to stand in the full rush of the flooding of Jordan? And Gossip says that when he wanted to fling away from God, the question that haunted him was, fling away to what? Wiesel's terrible lament ends by saying, I was alone in the world without God and without man. Fling away to what, you see? The prophet here does not do that.
Well, here the basic image that I heard him speak in Minneapolis once, he says that it's the 40 years in the wilderness in reverse. Where there was a pillar of fire, a column of smoke by day, and a pillar of fire by night to guide us there in the ovens. Where there was manna, there is starvation. And where there is Moses, we are all divided. So the entire 40 years was turned into a solitude. It was the basic image of this book. And some of the other.
You mean in night?
Night.
In Wiesel's book, yeah. I guess what I'm trying to do is to contrast Habakkuk and Wiesel, because Habakkuk 2 says, what will I answer concerning my complaint? And then he replies, the Lord answered me, write the vision, make it plain on the tablets, so he may run who reads it. For still the vision awaits its time. It hastens to the end. It will not lie. If it seems slow, wait for it. It will surely come, it will not delay. Behold, he whose soul is not upright in him shall fail, but the righteous shall live by his faith. Moreover, wine is treacherous, the arrogant man shall not abide. His greed is as wide as Sheol, like death he has never enough. He gathers for himself all nations and collects as his own all peoples. Habakkuk is saying here that he will not be defeated by the defeat, that he will not be plunged into despair by the vision of destruction and exile that he experiences, and that in the end the righteous still will live by faith. I want to ask us in a moment what that means, but I'd like to end with the prayer of chapter 3, because it has the same sort of power of hope in it. The song goes like this. O Lord, I have heard the report of thee, and thy work, O Lord, do I fear. In the midst of the years, renew it. In the midst of the years, make it known. In wrath, remember mercy. God came from Teman, and the Holy One from Mount Paran. His glory covered the heavens, and the earth was full of his praise. His brightness was like the light. Rays flashed from his hand. There he veiled his power. Before him went pestilence, and plague followed close behind. He stood and measured the earth. He looked and shook the nations, and the eternal mountains were scattered. The everlasting hills sank low. His ways were as of old. I saw the tents of Cushan in affliction. The curtains of the land of Midian did tremble. Was thy wrath against the rivers, O Lord? Was thy anger against the rivers? Or thy indignation against the sea? When thou didst ride upon thy horses upon the chariot of victory, thou didst strip the sheath from thy bow and put arrows to the string. Thou didst cleave the earth with rivers. The mountains saw thee and writhed. The raging waters swept on. The deep grave gave forth its voice. It lifted its hands on high. The sun and moon stood still in their habitation. At the light of thine arrows as they sped, at the flash of thy glittering spear, thou didst bestride the earth in fury. Thou didst trample the nations in anger. Thou wentest forth for the salvation of thy people. For the salvation of thy anointed, thou didst crush the head of the wicked, laying him bare from thigh to neck. Thou didst pierce with thy shafts the head of his warriors, who came like a whirlwind to scatter me, rejoicing as if to devour the poor in secret. Thou didst trample the sea with thy horses, the surging of mighty waters. And now the concluding praise again. I hear, and my body trembles. My lips quiver at the sound. Rottenness enters into my bones. My steps totter beneath me. I will quietly wait for the day of trouble to come upon people who invade us. Though the fig tree do not blossom, nor fruit be on the vines, the produce of the olive fail, and the fields yield no food, the flock be cut off from the fold, and there be no herd in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in the Lord, I will joy in the God of my salvation. God the Lord is my strength. He makes my feet like hinds' feet. He makes me tread upon my high places. As a prophet looks at exile, at destruction, he enters into it and says, if God is doing it, it can't be all bad. They had not the vision of hindsight. They did not know that out of the exile would come the Torah and the institutions that have enabled Judaism to survive to this day. They did not know that that out of exile would come, in a sense, the kind of incredible strength and religious vision that has sustained the Jews through thousands and thousands of years. That we can see now. Habakkuk is simply looking into the destruction, and he will not let it in the end rob him of his trust in God. Though the fig tree do not blossom, nor fruit be on the vines, the produce of the olive fail, and the fields yield no food, the flock be cut off from the fold, and there be no herd in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in the Lord, I will joy in the God of my salvation. See, that's an incredible, I think, an incredible testimony. It's the kind of thing that has to be said, I guess, to those of us who despair over the church. One of the questions that we ask seniors in constructive theology to deal with is the question of what makes you most despair over God? What is the greatest stumbling block to your being a Christian? And I am astonished at how many times people answer the church. That's not the case with Habakkuk, who sees the failure, the flawed character, the desperate weakness of the institutions that we have. I guess I need to listen to Habakkuk because I've seen almost all of the institutions in which I had such confidence when I left seminary 25 or more years ago. I've seen them all just evaporate. Movements in which I thought there was some hope don't seem to be alleviating very much of the problem. I'm already sort of in exile from my father's and my grandfather's church. Not that the ALC is all that bad an exile to be in, but nevertheless, it's not quite the same. The United Nations has not turned out to be the kind of instrument that that many people hoped for. The country, America, the bloom has certainly gone from that for me. I talked about that, I guess, here on the 4th of July. And I look at Habakkuk and I'm astonished. The relationship between Habakkuk and Jeremiah, I think, is evident. Jeremiah says that the prophets who try to read the goodness of God from the circumstances of history and from our lives are the false prophets, that the grounds of hope in God must lie elsewhere. And I want to turn just to one other thing of Wiesel's, a classic passage in which he describes an execution. There was a young boy in the camp. The Dutchman, who was an Oberkapo, and this young boy, or several people, and this young boy were discovered to be part of a sabotage enterprise. One day the electric power station at Buna was blown up. The Gestapo summoned to the spot suspected sabotage. They found a trail. It eventually led to the Dutch Oberkapo, and there, after a search, they found an important stock of arms. The Oberkapo was arrested immediately, tortured for a period of weeks, but in vain. He would not give a single name. He was transferred to Auschwitz. We never heard of him again. But his little servant had been left behind in the camp, in prison. Also put to torture, he too would not speak. The SS sentenced him to death with two other prisoners who had been discovered with arms. One day when we came back from work, we saw three gallows rearing up in the assembly place. Three black crows. Roll call. SS all around us. Machine guns trained. The traditional ceremony. Three victims in chains. One of them the little servant, the sad-eyed angel. The SS seemed more preoccupied than usual. To hang a young boy in front of thousands of spectators was no light matter. The head of the camp read the verdict, all eyes on the child. He was pale, almost calm, biting his lips. The gallows threw its shadow over him. This time the Lagerkapo refused to act as executioner. Three SS replaced him. The three victims mounted together on the chairs. Three necks were placed at the same moment within the nooses. Long live liberty, cried the two adults, but the child was silent. Where is God? Where is he? Someone behind me asked. At a sign from the head of the camp, the three chairs tipped over. Total silence throughout the camp. On the horizon, the sun was setting. Bare your heads, yelled the head of the camp, his voice raucous. We were weeping. Cover your heads. And the march past began. The two adults were no longer alive. But the third rope was still moving, being so light, the child still alive. For more than half an hour, he hung there, struggling between life and death, dying in slow agony under our eyes. And we had to look him full in the face as we marched past. Behind me, I heard the same man asking, where is God now? And I heard a voice within me answer, where is he? Here he is. He is hanging here on this gallows. I think that's what Christians are saying as the ground of their capacity to hope in God. It is the fact that God himself has become a victim with us, or at least with all of those who suffer unjustly. I think what makes it possible for us to join in the word of Habakkuk, to rejoice in the Lord and to joy in the God of our salvation, is that he has not only not abandoned us, but he has joined us, and joined us at the point at which we are most the victims of suffering. That's what makes it possible for us to go into exile, to recognize that the judgment of God need not be feared if it is indeed God's judgment. And I think that's where Habakkuk leaves us. Well, the most famous verse here is surely verse 4 of chapter 2, the righteous shall live by his faith. What do you think that means? Maybe that's a place for us to start talking a little bit today.
Starting to make me think a little bit.
Well, yes, Paul quotes this verse in a famous passage in Romans. I think it's where, Romans 1, 16 and 17. Mm-hmm. Interesting context that Paul puts it into. I am not ashamed of the gospel. It is the power of God for salvation to everyone who has faith, to Jew first and also to Greek, for in it the righteousness of God is revealed through faith for faith, as it is written, he who through faith is righteous shall live. Now that's Paul's version of the righteous shall live by faith. That is to say, what enables us to survive judgment without despair, to endure judgment, I don't mean to survive it, but to endure judgment without despair, is to have faith. But it is not the faith that saves, it is in the end God who saves, and the question is how. Okay, well, we're back to Habakkuk again.